How does ecology play into public health? That's the topic of a speech by Dr. David Suzuki, the broadcaster, author, and biologist, speaking in Vancouver on November 29, 2006. This recording is courtesy of the Necessary Voices Society. Find them at necessaryvoices.org. Part 2 of 2.
When I began to stay with and learn from First Nations people, I just listened to the way they talked, and very quickly they began to talk about Mother Earth, and I would say, well, that's a good way of putting it, you know, Mother Earth, yeah. They'd say, listen, Suzuki, you don't get it. We're not speaking poetically or metaphorically. We mean it literally. The Earth is our mother. And as a student, and I acquired this knowledge from my First Nations brothers and sisters, I realized that science corroborates exactly these ancient wisdoms. That we environmentalists have framed the problem that we face the wrong way. We'd always thought the environment's out there and we're here and we've got to regulate our interaction with the environment. But that's not the case at all. We are literally the environment. There is no separation between us. The earth is our mother because we are created out of the four sacred elements, earth, air, fire, and water. Now, what does that mean? When every one of us was born, the minute we left our mother's body, the very first thing that we needed was a breath of air. And from that moment on to the last breath we take before we die, we need air 15 to 40 times a minute, and we never even think about it. So I want you to think about it now. You take a breath, and it's so easy. Just, you know, 3 to 4 liters of air deep into the most intimate part of our bodies, into our lungs. And you know lungs, if you've ever been to a butcher shop, they're the funny, yucky, little squishy things that, funny, the texture of a lung is funny because they're mostly air. Each of our lungs has about 300 million capsules or alveoli. These are little grape-like structures around a straw or bronchiole, and we have 300 million of them. Why do we need so many? To give it the surface area to come into contact with the air. If you flatten the alveoli out into 2 dimensions, they would cover a tennis court. So that's how much surface area is all wrinkled up into our lungs. And each alveolus is lined with a 3-layered membrane called a surfactant that reduces surface tension, so when the air comes into contact with it, it sticks or fuses. Instantly, carbon dioxide rushes out of our bodies. Oxygen and whatever else is in the air rushes into our bodies. Hemoglobin molecules and red blood cells grab onto the oxygen, and with each beat of our heart, oxygen is pumped to every part of our bodies. And when we breathe out, we don't exhaust all the air in our lungs. If we did, our lungs would collapse. About half of the air stays in your lungs even when you breathe out. So the point I'm making is, you can't draw a line and say the air ends here and I begin there. There is no line. The air is in us, it's stuck to us, and it's circulating through our bodies. We are the air. And the air that does come out of my nose very quickly mixes in this room and goes straight up your nose. So if you are air and I am air, then we are each other. We're not individuals walking around separately. We're stuck together. We're all stuck in this matrix of air, not only with each other, but we're fused with the trees and the birds and the snakes and the worms that are all using that same air. And there's this wonderful thought exercise that Harlow Shapley, an American astronomer, did many years ago. He said, I'd like to follow what happens to one breath of air. How do you do that? 98% of the air is oxygen and nitrogen. You breathe it in, oxygen and nitrogen go into your body. When you breathe out, a lot of the oxygen never comes back out. That's why we breathe every minute, for the oxygen. Some of the nitrogen also stays in our bodies. But 1% of the air is an element called argon. Argon, if you remember your chemistry lessons, was one of the noble gases. Chemically inert, doesn't react with anything. You breathe it in, goes into your body, breathe it out, comes right back out. So argon is a good marker to follow a breath of air. It's 1% of the air. How many atoms of argon in a breath of air? 3 times 10 to the 18th. 3 followed by 18 zero. So take it from me, that's a lot of argon, okay? So let's follow one breath of air that comes out of Irv's nose here. One breath of air within a few minutes through mixing. Every one of us is breathing gazillions of argon atoms from that one original breath that Irv took a few minutes ago. But now the door is open. This is a very leaky place. Out that air goes. That breath soon is circulated all across Vancouver, across the Pacific Ocean, around the world. And 1 year later, according to Shapley, every breath you take wherever you are will have about 15 argon atoms from that one original breath that Irv took a year before. So on that basis, Shapley calculates every breath you take has millions of argon atoms that were once in the bodies of Joan of Arc and Jesus Christ. That every breath you take has millions of argon atoms that were in the bodies of dinosaurs 65 million years ago. That every breath you take will suffuse the lives of terrestrial creatures as far as we can see into the future. So air, surely air deserves what our First Nations people tell us it is, a sacred substance. Air should be sacred. Whatever we do to the air, if we are air, we do to ourselves. Our great boast is that we're intelligent. What intelligent creature, knowing the role that air plays in our lives, would then use air as a toxic dump? Whatever we do to the air, we do directly to ourselves. And a few years ago, coal miners took canaries down in the coal mine with them. Why did they do that? Canaries are super sensitive to hydrogen sulfide, a poison. So when the canary keeled over, they didn't say, "Hey, Irv, come on over here. That bird just fell down. Do you think it'll be harmful to us?" They hauled their asses out of there as fast as they could go. That's why they got the canaries down there, to give them a few minutes of early warning before they were killed by the air. Canaries are falling all around us today. Plants and animals that can no longer survive because of what we've done to the air. And now we've ignored that. Our own children have become the canaries, and we're still not paying attention to it. 15% of children in Canada today are going to develop asthma. Asthma is not something that is normal. It's not genetic. I know that doctors, you ask a doctor, "Well, what's causing this asthma epidemic?" "Oh, well, you know, there are dust mites and allergens and secondhand smoke." Listen, doc, we're breathing 15 to 40 times a minute and filtering whatever is in it. Don't we think maybe it's got something to do with what we're doing to the air? We are the air. Whatever we do to the air, we do to ourselves. And our children now have become the canaries in the coal mine, telling us that something's wrong. Something every one of you should do. A few years ago, when I realized the epidemic level of asthma, I said, "We got to do a show on asthma." I said, "Let's wait for a smog alert day in Toronto. We'll send a crew down to the Toronto General Emergency Ward." Well, you don't have to wait very long in the summers in Toronto now. Smog alert came up. We rushed down. I couldn't believe it, and every one of you should go and witness this on a smog alert day. It was packed with old people and children literally having crises where they were going to die because they couldn't breathe. And what shocked me in this was I watched people bringing their children or their parents in, scared stiff they wouldn't make it to see a doctor, and they would have done anything to keep their parents or their children from having these terrible epidemics or crises. And yet many of them drove up in a sports utility vehicle. And I thought, there's our problem. It's not that we don't love our parents or our children, but we've so shattered the world that we no longer see the connections. The act of getting in a car and driving 5 or 10 blocks instead of walking, sure, it has huge repercussions. That's why we got to go to the gym and work out, because we're getting fat, because we want to take this vehicle for the convenience. But that vehicle is pouring its effluents out of its tailpipe into that thin layer of air. And the problem is, we think the air goes up to the stars. It's only about 10 kilometers deep. If you reduce the Earth to the size of a basketball, the atmosphere that keeps us alive would be thinner than a layer of saran wrap. And that's it. That's what sustains us, and that's what all of our chimneys from our factories and all of our exhaust pipes from our cars are pumping their effluence into that layer of saran wrap, and that's why we got problems. And that's why we're heating the planet, because of greenhouse gases. We are air. Whatever we do to the air, we do to ourselves. We are the water, because every one of us is over 60% water by weight. The skinnier you are, the more percentage you are of water. And, you know, we're basically a big blob of water with enough organic thickener added so we don't dribble away on the floor. But the problem with it is that we leak water all the time, right? It comes out of our skin and our eyes and our nose and our crotch, and we lose water. But, you know, our bodies don't have a big gauge saying water level on it. But if we drank 1 milliliter of water more a day than we lose, well, in a matter of weeks, we'd blow up. If we drank 1 milliliter of water less a day than we lose, we'd just shrivel away. But we don't, because our body is constantly monitoring how much water there is. And if you've been to the pub and you've had too much, your body will tell you very quickly, get rid of some of that water. Or that if you have to top up on a hot day, your body will tell you. And it manages that water perfectly. And when you take a drink of water, do you think that's just Vancouver water? Of course not. I mean, the hydrologic cycle is what renews, replenishes the water all over the earth. So thanks to the hydrologic cycle, of which we are a part, we drink water and we return it back to the hydrologic cycle. We're drinking molecules of water that have come from all of the oceans of the world, that have evaporated off the canopies of the Amazon and the steppes of Russia and the prairies of Canada. We are water. Whatever we do to the water, we do to ourselves. So what intelligent creature, knowing that we're 60 to 70% water, would then use water as a toxic dump and think somehow it's going to go away? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. And then worry about our health. We are the earth, because every bit of our food comes from the earth and was once living. Every bit of our food was once alive. We take this creature, this plant or animal, tear it apart in our mouths, and make it into our own bodies. We are the earth. What intelligent creature, knowing that, would use the earth not only as a toxic dump, but spray toxic chemicals directly on to the things that we're going to eat and put into our own bodies? And then wonder, gee, I wonder why there's an epidemic of allergies. I wonder why breast cancer is at epidemic levels in women. I mean, whatever. If the earth is not healthy, how can we possibly be healthy? The problem we face today is that we live within time frames of action defined by politicians and the corporate sector. Corporate agendas today are driven by quarterly reports, and in the quarterly reports, the whole thrust is to maximize profit. So there's very little in the corporate agenda that worries about the health of people or the state of the earth. That's not a part of the corporate agenda. And if they're polluting the planet, I've had many arguments with leaders of corporations. They say, look, your issue isn't with me. We're doing everything within the letter of the law. If you don't like what we're doing, your argument is with government. They set the laws within which we operate. You go to a politician, well, of course, the problem with politicians, and this is not because they're stupid or evil, the game of politics requires that the first thing anyone elected to office must be concerned about is re-election. There's no point getting elected to office if you're going to be a one-term officer. You want to have more than one term. Well, that means that what you've got to do then is something, whatever you do, has got to pay off before the next election. There's no point doing something that doesn't give you bragging rights to the electorate before the next election. Global warming, an issue like global warming, is simply too big and too far into the future for a politician to take the heat for what has to be done today. Politician of necessity must be focused on people who are going to vote before the next election. Children don't vote. Children are not on the political agenda. Politicians don't get credit for doing the right thing for our children. Future generations don't even exist. They're not on the political agenda. For that matter, trees don't vote. Fish don't vote. The air doesn't vote. All of the important things that keep us alive have no representation in our government. When you have a minister of forests, he's not there to look after the forests. He's there to look after the human beings that want to use the forests. It's a very different thing. Similarly, for the Minister of Oceans and Fisheries, doesn't give a damn about the state of the oceans and fish. It's about the people that are going to depend on the oceans and fish. Our premier said this October, and I want to quote because it's quite stunning. This is October of this year. Let's create communities where residents can choose to walk or bike more and get out of their cars. That means creating compact, pedestrian-friendly communities that are a mix of land uses and that meet the diversity of needs of seniors and young families and all of us in British Columbia. The results of properly planned, mixed-use, higher-density communities are measurably better physical fitness, a reduced likelihood of obesity and traffic crash risk, and fewer air pollutants per capita than residents of more automobile-oriented communities. Congratulations, Mr. Campbell. Thank you for articulating that. A wonderful statement. Now, he understands that there are negative effects of urban sprawl. Sprawl increases travel costs, transportation costs, and all sorts of attendant side effects. Poor air quality, poor health, higher policing costs, higher servicing costs for water, sewage, municipal infrastructure. Now, this isn't an earth-shattering revelation. We've known this for a long, long time. Thank you, Mr. Campbell, for saying that. Why, then, are you talking about twinning the Portman Bridge, which we know is being rejected by Vancouver and surrounding communities, and yet will increase urban sprawl, dependence on cars, increase pollution, and all of the things that he claims he would like to avoid by the vision that he has. The Gateway program is going to cost billions and billions of dollars. And believe me, within a year or two, the traffic is going to be just as packed on those highways, and then the demand will be for tripling the Portman. I mean, it's just we know that expanding the roads in order to cater to the car doesn't work. He's got the vision, but he hasn't figured out what has to be done to realize the vision. The polls today suggest that health is now the number one issue for Canadians. The environment is number two. To me, there's no separation. We cannot be healthy if the earth isn't healthy. So health and environment, as you are doing now in this conference, health and the environment are inseparable. They're the same. Which means that the number one issue in the next election is going to be the issue that we're concerned about here. The problem is that we've got to keep that framework on the agenda. This government has presided over extreme fires in Kelowna and near Salmon Arm, the destruction of forests by pine beetles, water shortages on Vancouver Island in a rainforest, salmon runs impacted by warming water. These are all related to the fact that the planet is getting warmer. Yet this same government, knowing and seeing the impact of global warming on this province, is committed to full tilt exploitation of coal bed methane, is now committed to building two more coal-burning generators, wants to dam the Peace River, drill for oil off Heckett Strait, will not act to protect the last few pairs of spotted owls in this country, is considering protection of mountain caribou herds by killing predators like grizzlies, wolves, and wolverines, but never considers the biggest predator in that whole food chain, which is us. So it's tragic to me that Mr. Campbell can so clearly articulate a vision of what we should build communities to be like, and yet so clearly have no clue how you go about setting in place the things that have to be done to realize that vision. That's why at my foundation we've said we can't just keep hammering politicians. We've now got to go show leadership by what we do ourselves. We've got to take responsibility and begin to change our lifestyle in a way that is more sustainable in terms of the earth itself. And so that's why my foundation has developed the Nature Challenge, the 10 most effective things that each of us can do to begin to lighten our impact on the earth. And I've got some out on the table outside. Please have a look at this. Please sign up. Because it's more than just the fact that each of us will begin to act. I believe that collectively, if there are enough of us, we can have a very powerful political message. If only one or two of us do these 10 things, of course, it's insignificant. But I believe hundreds of thousands of us doing a few of these things can have a very concrete and measurable impact. We have over 300,000 Canadians signed up today to take the Nature Challenge. I'd like to get 1 million. Because I believe if I get 1 million, I can go to any politician, Stephen Harper, anybody, and say 1 million Canadians are taking the Nature Challenge. Will you sign? And every one of them will. Because that's how we're going to bring about change, by us leading the people that we elect to office. And I figure if Rick Mercer could get 1.5 million Canadians to sign up to change Stockwell Day's name to Doris Day, surely we could get 1 million Canadians signed up taking the Nature Challenge. So please, if you care about health of us and the planet, sign up to take the Nature Challenge at some point. But we've done something that I think is very, very exciting, that should show leadership for our politicians. When we're battling over an issue with politicians or business people, we're so closely tied into the battle that we're not asking the more important question, where are we going? Where are we heading? So a few years ago, we asked David Boyd, an environmental lawyer, to begin to draft a document that would say, let's look ahead a generation. Let's look to the year 2030 and ask, what would we like Vancouver or Canada to be by 2030? How about a Canada or a Vancouver where you could drink the water out of any river or lake? How about a Canada where the air is clean and we don't have epidemic levels of asthma? How about a Canada where you could catch a fish and eat it and not worry about what's in it? When you define a Canada or a vision that way, everybody agrees. I've taken that vision for 2030 to the business community in Vancouver, Calgary, and Toronto, to the multi-faith community in Toronto, to the FCM, the Federation of Canadian Municipalities, the mayors of cities across Canada. I took it to the Prime Minister when Paul Martin was Prime Minister, and everybody agrees, yes, that is a Canada or a Vancouver that I would like to see. So by putting a vision, looking ahead, we've accomplished two important things. We're no longer fighting. We're all on the same side. We all want to achieve that vision. And we now know where we want to go. We've got a target. So it means when we're getting ready to do a battle over a dam or drilling for oil or whatever, we say, wait a minute now, what will get us closer to the target we want to achieve by 2030? So that's a very powerful thing. We're now together and we've got a direction. So the question is, can we achieve what we call sustainability within a generation? So if you divide our activities into 9 important areas, food, water, waste, forests, energy, into 9 categories, we can ask, can we get in each of these categories to that target? And we believe we can. What it means is we've got to have concrete targets. This is what you've got to do by year 1, year 2, year 5, year 10. And then we believe we can achieve sustainability within a generation. We've taken it to Harvard University in November of last year. They said there's no document like this in the States. They hired two researchers. They've now made an American version of sustainability within a generation. And they're now taking that document to an umbrella organization for the 30 largest environmental groups in the United States. And these are all groups with many millions of American members. And asking this umbrella group to accept sustainability within a generation as their overarching strategy and vision. And they'll all work towards that. If we can get that, that'll be huge. Australian Conservation Foundation is making an Australian version. So sustainability within a generation has been a very, very powerful document. And we're asking communities all across Canada, download this from our website. Don't bother about worrying about giving us credit for it. We just want that out there. Begin the process within communities of visioning and saying, where do we want Vancouver by the year 2030? Let's get a vision for this country. You know, one thing I've been doing for the last 27 years when my older daughter was born, I said, I want my children to know that food is seasonal. At the end of June every year, let's go to Kelowna, to the Okanagan and pick cherries and celebrate cherry season and eat cherries until we have diarrhea and we're sick as hell and then look forward to picking cherries the next year. So for 27 years, we've taken our children at cherry time and reveled in the cherry season. But what is shocking to me is in those 27 years, I've seen the Okanagan deteriorate by the flood of people in, and the air is now just being polluted, and cherry trees are coming down to build vineyards, and you've got traffic jams in Kelowna and Penticton, and you have fights on holiday weekends. There was no sense of what is it that we like about Kelowna? Why are we living in the Okanagan? And let's protect those things that we love above anything else. We should be doing that for Vancouver. Why are we serving the car, for God's sake? We should be asking, why do we love this city? Why is it such a great place? And those values must come before anything else. And we've got to fight to protect them. And visioning, let's have a vision, Vancouver 2030, and get on with that. And so I'd like to end by saying all of that, the visioning and the health of our communities and the health of Mother Earth are related very much to the health of individual people. And that's the challenge. Now, let's get them all back into balance. Thank you very much.
That concludes the second part of a speech by Dr. David Suzuki, the biologist and broadcaster, on November the 29th, 2006, given to the BC Public Health Association in Vancouver. It was recorded by the Necessary Voices Society. Find them at necessaryvoices.org.